morning, Brother John.
Good morning, Jerry.
Hey, up here in Milwaukee, watching some baseball, so, having a pretty good day.
All right. Is it a little rainy up there?
Yeah, it's going to rain most of the day, but fortunately, since I'm going to a game with a retractable dome, I don't have to worry about a rain out. One of the reasons I decided to come up here to see some baseball, since there's none in Chicago this weekend, both the Cubs and the White Sox are out of town. So here I am, just kind of hanging.
Yeah, we're looking at a kind of an overcast morning, but I think it's going to burn off. We had some real heat yesterday, got close to 100, so probably looking more of the same today. But for now, cool and comfy. So we got a big show today, huh?
Yeah, we got a lot on our plate, that's for sure.
Okay, we're going to change up our order a little bit. And instead of doing the film in the middle, we're going to do it at the end. And our fake news is not so fake, although there's a fake aspect to it we'll discuss. And we're going to start out with baseball. But in this case, baseball takes place where, John?
Well, baseball takes place in a lot of different venues, et cetera. And we're going to concentrate on the congressional baseball game today, since it's been in the news, obviously.
Yep.
But, you know, there's a backstory here that I think is kind of interesting. The fact is that these congressmen take this baseball game very seriously. I mean, this is not something where they just all of a sudden come together and play ball. I mean, and the competitiveness kind of shows in terms of the results that show that it's pretty tight. You can go to a variety of sources and come up with different wins and loss records for it, but somewhere around 39, 40 games for each the Democrats and the Republicans. And so, you know, it's something which is, like I said before, they look forward to it. It's fun, but it's also very competitive. So where does all this start? Where do we start with the beginning of the congressional game?
When did it start?
It was 1909. What happened was that there was a representative who only served one term from Pennsylvania by the name of John Tenner, T-E-N-E-R. Now, John happened to be a major league pitcher.
Oh.
So, in fact, his experiences and what he's done in terms of both politics and sports are about balanced. He was a pitcher back in the 1880s, large man, 6'4", decided to start to organize this game. So the first game takes place in 1909. Little background on John. The reason he only served one term as a representative from Pennsylvania was because apparently political powers to be in Pennsylvania decided that John should run for governor. So he became governor of Pennsylvania after that. And concurrently, during the teens, between 1910 and 1918, he was also the president of the National League of Baseball. So he's got a couple of so he's got a full plate.
And
so
to speak,
during his tenure as a National League president, this is not exactly what you call a quiet time in baseball history. We've got the introduction of a new league, the Federal League. We've got the war. We've got a lot of labor strife. So John, had a significant role in terms of working all that out. So as we take a look here, you know, the fact is that this game, you know, doesn't go just from 1909 to 2017. It's gone through a variety of interruptions. You know, the Depression was part of it. There's a period of time, the Second World War. In addition to the fact, there was a period of time in the 30s, in the Depression time, where they were playing it every other year. So you're not going to be able to say 2017 subtract 1909, you got so many games, because there is a lot of times where they didn't. In fact, I think the most interesting one was back in the 50s, where to demonstrate how serious this thing got, the Speaker of the House actually felt, Sam Rayburn, felt that the games were coming way too serious. So he said, that's the end of them. So from 1958 through 1962, they didn't revive them again until we had a new speaker, John McCormick from Massachusetts in 1962.
What?
So, it's pretty
blasphemy.
Crazy. Yeah, I agree. I mean, deciding not to play baseball, come on. That's an act of treason. So, the thing is that what amazes me is the seriousness of it. First thing is that it's usually sponsored by somebody. Sears and Roebuck has sponsored it before. Major League Baseball has. The other thing is that they've played these games in major league venues. You can take a look at the locations. Go back to Griffith Stadium, which was the home of the Washington Senators. You've got
right.
the DC Stadium in the '60s. In fact, for a while, when there wasn't Major League Baseball in Washington, they were playing the game up in Memorial Stadium, which is Baltimore's park, Baltimore Orioles ballpark. You've got the game being played at a minor league venue from 1995 to 2004, the Triple-A club of the Bowie Bay Sox. Now it's, you know, since we've got the new stadium in and a new team in D.C., the Nationals, it's been played there in recent years. To show you how serious this is, they've actually at various points in time broadcasted this game on radio. They've had baseball cards of the Senators. They have their own Hall of Fame of participants in the game. So, I mean, it's really amazing. Serious stuff. Now, up until 1949, only the House members participated in this. And the Senators didn't come on board until Senators as political Senators.
I understand.
1950.
Yeah.
So,
They tend to be a little older. Right.
Yeah, you're right. So, but they felt that they should be, you know, part of it. So we got, Democrats versus Republicans. And I guess the one Major League Baseball player that's been noted, in fact, every year he played for about 5 or 6 years, was a Senate, a House member from the state of North Carolina by the name of Wilmer Vinegar Ben Mizell.
Yeah.
This is a baseball player that's near and dear to our hearts because he's a St. Louis Cardinal in the 50s, mm-hmm. and he was known for having extremely fast velocity on his pitches, but he was a little wild, so he never kind of
right.
And he also served 2 years in the service, and the time while he's in the service, it's everybody's just kind of imagining this guy much greater than he was when he went into the service. So there was a built-up kind of greatness that this guy was able to create just by not playing. But when he comes back, he has a fairly good career. But then he retires and becomes a senator. And sure enough, he's a very important part of the team.
Was he a Democrat or Republican?
He was a Republican. So every year that he played, they won. A couple of years, they were desperate in terms of trying to find somebody to pitch because pitching was proved to be a problem. So back in 1963, they decided to just bring in a major league pitcher to pitch for both teams. So they'd done some kind of quirky stuff like that.
That's interesting.
They broke the color line in 1971 when the first African Americans joined the game.
Hold on a sec. Was that a color line, or was it just that there weren't enough black senators and congressmen?
Well, it's the same thing as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
Yeah. Gotcha. I mean, you can't have a. I don't know. I'm not saying that. Obviously, I think we've got in the 60s. We had Brooks from Massachusetts. Well, we had a congressman who could have potentially a minority congressman who could have played. But these are the first time African Americans actually participated in the game.
Interesting.
So, So that's kind of the quirk. You know, and the other thing, if you notice the most recent game was obviously just a couple days ago, and the Democrats won. And like I said, it's highly contested as to exactly how many games have been played, but it's very even. So I know some newspaper accounts give it 39-39. Wiki says 42-39.
Who knows?
It's close.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was kind of intrigued by what these guys wear for uniforms.
Yeah.
And they're all over the place. I mean, some of them, they do something to represent their state. But that could be their college. that could be something. I saw one guy was playing, Arizona guy had a Diamondback uniform on, so it might be a major league club that's in their state. Or it might be a uniform with a state name on it. So they're just kind of a motley crew as they go out there and play. So I thought that was an interesting part of it.
Well, I think we'll know the country's on the right track when actually these guys, they, instead of examining someone's politics as to whether they're going to run and get support from the party, they'll say, we need this guy on the baseball team.
Yeah. Recruiting. Exactly. Yeah, recruiting is going to be good. That's when we show up. They actually have a trophy that it's kind of a convoluted way that you get it. And apparently if you win 3 out of 5 games you're given the roll call trophy. And there's been about a dozen of those handed out. So, there's a lot of, they're going through a lot of serious stuff here in terms of these games. It's interesting as you look through sometimes these are real slaughters. I see back in 2013, the Democrats won 22-0. A lot of times they roll up the scores on these. I mean, there's a couple of these games where there's 20 runs scored by one team. So it can get, it can get ugly is exactly right.
So that's probably why these things are so serious. Is these guys really shellacked us last year? We're gonna come back.
Yeah. I mean, there's vengeance in mind as they go through this. So that kind of pretty well tells a story in terms of it. I think it's nice background when we take a look at. I mean, obviously, the whole incident that we're going to be talking about takes place during a practice, and these guys are practicing like 7 o'clock in the morning. I mean, it also demonstrates how serious this whole thing that was taking.
If I may make an observation, and I just noticed this, I had just thought of it just now. In your discussion of the history of this game and the participants, the awards given out, the uniforms they wear, all this stuff, the one thing I notice is this is kind of a mess in a lot of ways, but it's a very recognizable mess. It sounds like the mess that is Senate and the Congress.
Interesting. Yeah.
I mean, they make all these weird decisions. They change it all the time according to, right? You see what I'm saying?
I didn't even, because Wiki has a list of all the games, and some of these outcomes are decided. Like, they can't decide whether it's a fly ball or a home run. There's a lot of craziness going on here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I agree. they're just kind of they're living out their job on the field.
It's very emblematic. Very emblematic of what's going on. Okay. So we got that. All right. So now here comes the interesting part. Let's talk about the event itself a little bit. There's several angles to this. And this segment we call fake news. And of course, people say, well, this is not fake. People got shot, et cetera, et cetera. Well, no, the event itself is not fake. The fallout from it afterwards, which we'll kind of discuss toward the end of this, is where the fake news element comes in. So it deserves the title, I will say. But the event itself, and what happened was definitely, it shook people up. And in a good way, I think, in a lot of ways. Unfortunate that all this stuff happened. Now, we're going to focus on what made this fellow, Mr. Hodgkinson, do this. What led him to this? And then that leads into our last segment on film. We're going to talk about the taxi driver.
Mm-hmm.
So a little background on Mr. Hodgkinson. He's from Belleville, Illinois, which people are going to say, oh, it's like a suburb of St. Louis. No. If you're a St. Louisan, anything on the east side of the river is not part of St. Louis, culturally, geographically, politically, any way you want to cut it. But once you get out of St. Louis, anything near St. Louis is St. Louis. So I'll just say that right now.
Yeah, you cross the creek, you're a whole nother turf. That's for sure. I would agree. I had some friends from Belleville.
Sure.
And it almost has kind of a small town flavor to it. It's, you don't even sense it's because of the physical barrier of a river. You don't even sense that it's a a part of the metropolitan area, although
they
got
large rural areas too.
Yes, they do. So,
okay,
yeah, I agree. It's a whole different thing, and so, but we were fairly close. We live fairly close to Belleville, being from St. Louis.
So the interesting thing about this guy is he's not that far away from our own age. How old was he, John? 66.
Yeah, 66. Recently retired from his house inspection business. He had his own business. Had it for a long period of time, and you know, it makes sense. You know, you say, well, either the guy just all of a sudden quit his job and go his way. No, I mean, this is a guy who appears to be a normal retiree who says, you know, I'm ready to retire and I'm going to stop my business.
Yeah, and so, in his household, his daughter and her child were living at the house there with him. And so he said to his wife, I'm going to take off for Washington, D.C., see if I can make a difference in what's going on up there. And this seems like a good time, et cetera, et cetera. He had already sold all of his businesses and liquidated almost everything.
Yeah.
And other than that, you know, nothing unusual here. So he just takes off in his van, which he now lives in, starting in March.
Right.
Now,
and
see,
places himself close to a YMCA, so at least he can take care of, you know, cleaning
hygiene.
Up this and that, hygiene and all that good stuff. And, it's a little quirky, but what are you going to do?
This would have been a sign for me. If I were his family, I would have gone, well, you're living in a truck? Or maybe he didn't tell them. I don't know. But anyways, this gets me thinking. And we're talking about motivations and what led up to this. Part of it is he was very partisan. He was a heavy-duty Bernie supporter. And, Bernie's primary campaign was really something to behold. I mean, he really had thousands and thousands of people come to these rallies, I guess you'd call them. And they were huge. And, you know, although Bernie's a peaceful guy, you know, he has language that is meant to provoke people to vote. To provoke people to take action and become activists, not to become assassins. But this guy drank the Kool-Aid, and he experienced it a little differently, I think, than the average Bernie bro. They hate it when we use that term, but he is a bro, and he did support Bernie, and he did go off the rails, though.
I would say when it all came out at the beginning, the people in Belleville were saying, well, he's a pretty regular guy, this and that. But as the last kind of couple of days have unfolded and more information comes out, I don't think there's some background stuff here that's just and a lot of it we don't have all the information, but they, he's got a long record of misdemeanors, including driving violations, battery actually with one of his foster daughters, DUIs and, a variety of little stuff that just seems to collect. And this is going back as far as 1988. The other thing is the family, they are licensed foster parents.
Right.
So, part of the battery has to do with one of the girls that they were basically the foster parent of. So we got a couple of different things going on here in that regard. One of those daughters ended up killing herself by dousing herself with gasoline.
Oh my God!
So,
really?
Yeah.
That's severe.
That's not the one that was beat up or battery charged. So you take a look at this and say, well, here's a guy that's basically says to his wife, "I'm out of here," and it just.
She's probably
thinking,
okay.
Wow.
She's probably fine. Evidently
he's probably breathing a sigh of relief. Yeah.
Yeah. He's volatile, obviously. So cut into the chase a little bit. March, he goes up to DC, starts hanging out, starts scoping out. We don't know what's going on in his head, when he made a decision, what happened, but something reached a boiling point, 3 days ago. And he shows up at the Diamond. The guys are out there. He calls out, are the Republicans or the Democrats on the field? Republicans. Thanks. Goes back to his van, proceeds to get a rifle and a handgun, 9mm. Now that, which is interesting. And then he gets behind home plate, behind a barrier, and starts picking them off. Double tapping them, too. And yeah, I guess it's unclear now, but maybe he was starting with the majority whip.
And yeah, I mean, they're all practicing out there, and they're in the, it's an informal practice. So as a result, it's not just congressmen that are out there. There are some of their staffers are out there in a variety of roles, either shagging balls or doing this or doing that.
Right.
So you got a mix of people. And but one of the things that sticks to my mind, I think the YMCA that he was basically staying, that he was close to with his truck, was right there near the ballpark.
Wow.
Correct? So
yes.
As a result,
yes.
It kind of makes you think, well, where does this all start in terms of him thinking of actually doing this incident? Since he's basically staying close to the ballpark for a long period of time. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of unanswered questions here, and I'm hoping
there are. And now, interestingly, another backstory is the Capitol Police. There were three Capitol Police gentlemen, and they were there to guard the majority of whip, who gets 24/7 protection from the Capitol Police. And the Capitol Police are called police, and they have the ranks the police have. They're not agents, although they've been reported as agents in the news. They do one thing. They protect the Capitol area, the Library of Congress, and the people around that, and especially the congressmen and women. So everyone has the option to get these protective details, I believe.
Yes.
But he luckily had them, and he had them with him at this game. Otherwise, there would have been a lot of dead people.
Well, the one thing about this, it's interesting you mentioned that the other congressmen have this option. And here we have a bunch of congressmen out there, but we only have several Capitol Police and only the ones that are with the whip.
Correct.
Which points out, and it's, I just know it from the reading an article in the local Sun-Times newspaper in Chicago, where the most of the congressmen don't want these guys because it leaves the impression that they've got an entourage, you know, so that they're special.
Yeah.
They want to have more interaction with their constituents.
Correct.
And so they feel that this creates a barrier when they have those. So,
yeah, Gabby Gifford being a prime example.
Yeah. And so this gets us back to a recent incident, Gabby Gifford from Arizona, where she was part of obviously was shot and seriously injured. I mean, it's impaired her to the point she couldn't continue on as a congresswoman.
Yeah.
But one of the things that came out of that, which we might see, is that for a period of time right after the incident with Gifford, Congressman Gifford, they ended up requiring these congressmen to take on some security. And later mm-hmm. on, it kind of dissipated. So
mm-hmm.
it'll be interesting to see what the reaction is in terms of the use of the Capitol Police as we go forward after this incident. So
yes, yes. One of the fallouts from this is that, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the tone and the rhetoric and the so-called conversation between Democrats and Republicans, both within the halls of Congress, but also nationwide. That this is a sign. And Paul Ryan gave a great speech saying, hey, we're Americans and all this good stuff. And it was nice. And so did Trump. Trump gave a great talk, too, and also showed a lot of humanity going to the hospital, visiting Scalise, the whip who really got shot up.
Yeah.
I thought to myself, well, I heard when I first heard the report, got shot in the hip. I thought to myself, well, poor guy's going to have a hip replacement. No, this went right through his lower abdomen. These things must have been 30-30s or something, some really, these were sniper bullets. Let's just call it what it is.
Yeah, they're not just piercing, they're tearing up your insides.
Oh, man. So this guy's had it bad and still has it bad. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's come out that he was on the brink of death when they basically brought him in. And since then, he's, I would say with guarded optimism, things are improving, but he's still got a long, long ways to go. He's had several
blood
operations.
It's internal bleeding. He had a lot of internal bleeding, which in some ways is better than external bleeding. You can staunch a wound on the outside. You can put your hand over it, put gauze and what have you, put pressure on it. But when it's inside, there's not a hell of a lot you can do. You just bleed. But there's pressure, back pressure. So it's a mixed bag. So it's a very, very bad situation. And poor guy. I really feel for him. And yeah, this will reduce some of the tone of the rhetoric. And one of the big spinoffs of this whole thing is now Bernie Sanders being criticized for his language and the comments he's made about Trump lately. And all this stuff, the plays in New York that Julius Caesar, where Trump is a Trump-looking Julius Caesar, gets assassinated. So this is all getting looked at. And I don't think it's unreasonable that people look at it. But here's the fine point, is that we want people to vote. We want people to get involved. That's our democracy. That's how it runs. And we have a bad record of voting in this country. So people like Bernie, people like Trump do a good job of getting people out to vote, but sometimes they do rile up the baser instincts in people. So they've got to look at that, right?
Yeah, it's rough. I mean, let's face it. You're talking a very minor, very, very minor portion, but a very significant out, when you're dealing with people like Hodgkinson. Mm-hmm. There are not many of them out there, but it only takes one to screw
things
up.
That's correct.
That's the problem.
That is the problem. Yeah. Well, so, you're 27,000 people come to a stadium, hear Bernie or Trump talk, and they don't go there for a prayer meeting. They're not there. They're just saying kumbaya. They're there to get worked up, and they do get worked up. And this guy got really worked up, obviously. And when Bernie lost the primary, he felt wronged. And, there's a lot of crappy things that went on during that primary. Then, Hillary Clinton runs a campaign against Trump. A lot of crappy things went on there. So this guy's carrying a load of crap.
Yeah, he's got a full load. There's no doubt about that.
And pretty obvious he's seriously bipolar or something. I'm not a doctor, but that's what I would say, something along those lines. And all that Bernie stuff fed his mania and got him going, and he liked it, and he didn't want to give it up. He got addicted to it. So, and he didn't know what to do. This is what he did. Went out and started shooting. And there's even a cell phone film of the shooting itself, if you want to look at it. And you don't see anyone going down or you don't see the shooter, but you hear everything, including the yelling on the field, the gunshots, 50, 60 rounds or something. I forget what the number is. A lot of bullets. And the guy had a handgun because he was thinking, at some point, police are going to come and try and take me down. And I might have to do close in combat style. Firing of a weapon, and handgun's better than a rifle. Boom. So this is thought out. This guy's not stupid. He's just a little more than a little crazy.
Yeah, a little off the beaten track for sure.
Mm.
But we also ought to point out that we've concentrated on the whip, Steve Solis, but there were other people injured, and there's some heroes involved in that regard. I know there's a congressman who had medical training in the armed services, in the army.
Medic,
and he came to the rescue of one of the staffers who was actually bleeding pretty bad, and put a tourniquet on him and was able to kind of get him onto the road to recovery. We've also got the Capitol Police.
Who, oh my God!
They've also were part of the injuries. So,
and they're like Secret Service. They will throw themselves in front of their
and that's part of what they did. That's what caused their injuries, was basically doing their job. The other thing, I guess, you've pointed out, and I just to emphasize and comment on, and that is the unity piece to this story, the upside, hopefully that. We find ourselves as a nation being able to come together when, things like this happen. The classic example being, 9/11, But it'll be interesting to see exactly how much we can coalesce and get things done, which has been a challenge in terms of Washington, D.C. And hopefully this will maybe turn it a little bit that allows a little more compromise to take place mm-hmm. rather than having this fractional way of doing business in Congress. So,
yep, agreed. Okay, so now we get to the film part, and mm-hmm. we thought long and hard about this. You know, what's a film that actually will help us understand, or maybe give us another example of somebody who is gets worked up into a fever and goes on a rampage with a gun. So we thought of several movies, and Taxi Driver is a great example, because here you got a guy played by Robert De Niro, Travis Bickle, and he obviously got some PTSD. This was before I think they called it that even hardly.
Yeah,
and he's got insomnia. He can't socialize. He's extremely awkward. He gets a huge crush on a girl, and you know, signs up for to volunteer for a political campaign that she's involved in so that he can be closer to her. And of course, he's the worst guy in the world to canvas or to do anything for a political campaign because he's awkward and a little strange. And he drives a taxi cab at night, obviously, I think it's night.
Yeah, go ahead. You know, the fact is that his environment is it doesn't help him much. He's he basically is in the picks up at night. His action's going to be in some of the Skid Row. Now we call it Skid Row, but actually the low life,
seedier, one of the seedier parts.
Yeah, parts of New York City. So he's exposed, and he makes it everybody fully aware of how the filth and all the the degrading things that are going on in his environment.
Because part of it affects him. Because part of it, he finally gets a date with Betsy, I think is the character's name, and she's kind of a highfalutin kind of gal, and he takes her to a European art film that's basically pornography, and of course she's deeply offended, and then he gets upset about that because he had his heart set on her and didn't know how to go about it. He's a Vietnam vet. He's got PTSD. You know, he's confused. He lives in kind of a shitbox apartment. Am I right? I mean, it looked like the place he lived looked like it was inducing some of this stuff. But anyways, he's got all that going on.
I'd like to take a step back a little bit on the movie, and because we picked a movie that fits this, but we've picked a movie that's considered one of the better movies of all time. I mean, you can we were talking about different rankings. The American Film Institute puts it in the top 50, but there are many, many ratings and whatever that show it as more like a top 10, top 5 movie.
Yeah,
we've also got a director, Martin Scorsese, who is Academy Award winner. He's done a variety of Goodfellas, King of Comedy, Casino, all kinds of very well-known movies. He's also, we've got the Travis being played by Robert De Niro at the sort of the beginning of his career, but it's at the time where he's just now hitting stardom because he's done the Part Two Godfather. And so you've got yourself a very, very well, we picked a movie that not only fits the role, but is a very famous movie. And I think that
Jodie Foster plays a teenage prostitute, 13 years old.
You got Sybil Shepherd playing Betsy. You got Albert Brooks as a co-worker. You've got the pimp played by Harvey Keitel. I mean, you've got a great casting here. I also found interesting was the guy who wrote this script, Paul Schrader. It's somewhat autobiographical for him because he apparently was in the film industry in L.A., in a lower position. And he did some things, I don't know the specifics, that basically alienated him from that. And he had a tough time getting back into the swing of things and was you know, feeling some of this of this loneliness that we see that that Robert De Niro as Travis is playing. The other thing that amazed me was that he did this. He wrote this screenplay in 10 days.
Wow.
So he's very prolific, you know, in terms of doing it. And he said one of his motivations was he had a gun there right beside him just to kind of, not he's going to use it, but I mean, it just kind of symbolized and kind of gave him an incentive to move on and get the whole thing done.
How do you deal with that? You know, I mean, people, we have this today a lot, is these guys come back from Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria. And, you know, it's so different there. You're living in a world with IEDs and you're fully armored and you got a gun and you use it. And so this is quite an adaptation. These guys, like, they go on R&R or they come back for a break or they between tours and what have you. And they have a very difficult time integrating into everyday society. And it's so different. And it's worse now than it even was back in Vietnam.
Well,
right?
There's because, a reason it's war. There's a, yeah. And
because
I can tell you
they over here, it's like there is no war.
Part of the problem here is that people, and I thought this through because I was in Vietnam for a year, and there is a piece of you that basically, I don't care what your position is over there, but once you get alienated distance-wise, people-wise, whatever, you're in a whole nother world, and the way you conduct yourself is going to be different.
Different rules,
and that's all part of it. And then coming back, it's hard to adjust. But here's a piece that I've kind of latched onto, and that is the fact is that we've given the soldiers so much protection in terms of what they have on, that we have a lot more soldiers that aren't dying that would have been good cases for the psychological distress. So what we're doing is we're basically keeping alive these guys who are suffering mentally in
their
a
bodies,
big way.
They're keeping their bodies alive.
Bodies alive, and their mind is, you know, is basically being subjected to all this. And in the past, we didn't have as big a problem, although there was a problem, because a lot of these guys are dying.
Yep. Wow.
So
but that's the truth.
Kind of, this is just something I kind of thought of. I've never read about it, but. That's the way I see it.
You're right. You're right. You're absolutely right. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, just think about it. You see these movies, and also sometimes you see actual footage, and these guys are geared up. And now our police here in the United States are starting to gear up too, and they have armor on, which this is all good. I'm not complaining about it or anything. And they have cameras all over their bodies. They're, you know, they've got weapons that are unbelievable.
And
their
vehicles that they're in too sometimes are part of it. You get ones that can't certain bullets can't pierce and rockets or whatever.
Right.
So and of course, what are they? They're inside these things as they're getting getting all this happening to them.
Yeah.
But they're still living.
Yeah. And also, I might point out that there's a lot of people coming back maimed, badly maimed.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Who
and
been dead.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
In previous wars.
Yep, exactly. So it's a bad situation, definitely. And here we got Travis Bickle right in the middle of all this mess. And so he's starting to melt down. He's spending more and more time in his room. He's starting to shave his head, paint his face, practice his gun handling in the mirror. And he starts practicing his social skills. And that culminates in the most famous line of the movie, which is, take it, John.
Well,
you're
looking at me. You're looking at me. You are talking to me. Yeah. That line. It's an ad-lib line, but the whole way that he continues to say it in different ways is a part of his actor training. He went to the Adler School of Acting. And apparently there was an exercise where they would give somebody a line and ask you to say it over and over and again in different ways.
Cool.
So his teaching, you know, not only does he come up with the line, but then his teaching kind of what he learned, it kind of kicks in. And before you know it, he's repeating it over and over again in different ways. And it becomes considered one of the top 10 movie quotes ever as a result.
Yeah. And the movie itself becomes a meme. Other movies have been, he used this movie inside of them. Hinckley, Travis Bickle was his hero, and that's why he, that's how and why he went after Reagan when he wanted to assassinate him. So this movie has a lot of controversy around it because of that. Mm-hmm. Too good, I guess.
But to some people, this movie is a vigilante movie.
Yes, it is to some people.
It has
right.
that element because what happens is as he you know gets ready to kind of use some of these weapons, he's confronted with a situation where he can where he needs to use them, but he's using them to get basically to shoot a pimp and a variety of other people. You know, because of that, the king areas that he had been in, and he kind of became friendly with a underage prostitute played by Jodie Foster, which is a whole other element to the movie.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that he becomes a hero because of getting rid of these decay, you know, these guys or these bad guys.
Yep.
And
he's up being a hero.
He ends up being a hero, which is so mind-boggling.
Because he himself thought that he would have shot himself, but he ran out of bullets.
Jeez.
Yeah, and the last thing he does before he passes out, right? The cops are right over him. He puts his finger to his head and you know does the thing with his thumb like he's shooting himself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's his outcome. You know,
right.
That's why he sees it. And when he wakes up, he's in hospital or whatever, and you know, and then. The whole thing resolves. The resolve of the movie is very, very interpreted different ways. And John and I have two different ways of looking at this.
Yes.
My resolve of the movie is, you know, the last bit of the movie is he ends up giving Betsy a ride in his taxi cab and says goodbye to her, and everything's good between them. And he, from my point of view, he looks like he's at peace. And he went through some kind of a process where he got whatever it was, his demons, exercised. And he's moving on, and yeah, he's a little bit of a hero. He doesn't take it too seriously because he knows himself that that wasn't what that was. But he feels like he's a whole human being again, and they move on. But John, you see it a little differently.
Yeah, I do. I don't know if the expression on his face at the end or what. You know, you could take that expression where there seems to be a sense of calm, but you also could take a look at it and say, well, you know what, I got still some more work to do here. The worst is, and you get the sense that maybe the worst is yet to come. Because we need to understand that that his motivation with all these guns, and he had a political assassination in mind. The campaign that Betsy's working on is for a senator. And during the movie, he feels that the senator, he doesn't feel very good about the senator. So as a result, the senator was in his mind as a target.
Yes.
So you're just wondering if, is that going to eventually fulfill itself? And that's what I sense when I, at the end of the movie, that again, the worst is yet to come. And again, it's, you can read interpretations on this. And it's all over the place.
It truly is.
Which just makes it a good movie, you know. It makes you think a little bit. So there's nothing wrong with that.
So you wonder, is Hodgkinson in the YMCA taking a shower, going, "You talking to me?"
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's something going on. There's a big blank spot that we don't know anything about that we'll probably get more detail on as time goes on, but it doesn't change the outcome. But it might help us understand, and I think that's the key thing here, is that, yeah, as a society, as a group of humans who have laws and live by laws, we need to figure some of this stuff out, and especially mental health issues. People are sent into war, and, you know, we'll help them with their bodies, but helping them with their minds is a really tough thing. I think the veteran groups do more for each other than the doctors, and that's kind of always the way it is too. I know with cancer, it's that way too. I get more help with my cancer talking to John and other people about it who have been through some of this than I do in talking to my doctor who's never had it.
There's something to be said for our dialogue, and also it's interesting. The support you just get from people in terms of a say, wow, you've been through a lot. And I guess I have, but it's, you know, but I don't think of it that way myself. And yeah, we kind of got a little off the beaten track here, but then
right. It's on the beaten track. I mean, this is the issue is that, you know, when people are hurt or hurting, they find ways to help themselves. And sometimes some people, this is Travis Bickle helping himself. This is Hodgkinson helping himself. You know, that's what they're doing because they can't figure it any other way. To them, nothing else comes to mind. Now you stand back and you're not involved and you have all kinds of suggestions for people like this. But guess what? They're not going to hear it. It may make it worse. Right.
That loneliness gives their mind an opportunity to kind of come up with some pretty wild and wacky things. And that's what we have with both these guys. You know, they're loners.
Yep.
That definitely plays into it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this could go in a lot of directions. We keep going for another half hour if we brought in ISIS and all that stuff, but we're not. So you guys, you guys take this any way you want to out there who are listening to this. And I want to thank John for his work on this thing and good job. And I think we got it. We got her done, huh?
Yeah, I think we got it done. I think it'll be interesting to see how it unfolds. I think, again, it's just like the movie. We'll just have to see how things play out.
Yeah. You know? All right.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, John, I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Sounds good. See you then, Jerry.
Okay, bye-bye.